On October 17, 2018, Canada will become the second nation, after Uruguay, to legalize marijuana. In doing so, we have stepped outside of our commitment to the United Nations to restrict the use of Class 1 controlled substances. To date, the UN and other nations have not responded negatively to our new legislation. Perhaps they're waiting and watching before determining if a response is required. Perhaps we can establish national protocols that will become an international standard. But where do we turn to for insights into the path from prohibition to legalization? The first state in the United States to legalize marijuana was Washington State. What lessons can we learn from its experience with legalization? Does marijuana use increase? Do DUIs rise? How do you measure, monitor, and ensure the highest standards? And how do you ensure use among teens does not increase? The issues are many, and they cover everything from policing to public health, growing, producing, quality, retail, and tax collection. Will banks allow marijuana producers, processors, and retailers to open bank accounts? Because without them, how are they going to pay their taxes? In Washington State, the national banks all said they were not going to launder drug money. The state had to pass a bill that allowed local banks to accept money from registered marijuana retailers and producers. Do we have to do the same thing here in Canada? These are just some of the many issues that will arise and need to be addressed. We invited Rick Garza, the director of the Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board, to join us for a conversation that matters about the lessons our neighbor to the south has learned since legalizing marijuana in 2012.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Welcome. And welcome to Victoria, where you're here to talk about your experience in the introduction and then the implementation of making marijuana accessible legally to the citizens of your state in Washington State. It's, you know, 6+ years or coming up on 6 years since you started to move in that direction. In a nutshell, first of all, how's it gone? And then let's get into some of the details.
Well, I think it was something we didn't have any idea. There was no roadmap. There was no path. For Colorado and Washington, the first two states in the nation, we actually looked to other countries to see if there was a model there. There wasn't. Nowhere in the world had they created a regulatory system for licensure, for enforcement, collection of taxes and fees. So we learned a little bit from Colorado because they had regulated medical marijuana for a number of years. So we worked with them to put it together. But I back up a little bit to the context of an initiative that passed, as you said, almost 6 years ago. Allison Holcomb, who is the ACLU policy director in Washington State, interesting enough, wrote the initiative to mimic Washington State coming out of prohibition for alcohol in 1934. Mm-hmm. Really strict licensing, enforcement, and then the collection of taxes. In fact, the Washington State model is based upon British Columbia, when we go back to coming out of prohibition in 1934. So unlike all the other states, we don't allow vertical integration. A producer or processor of cannabis cannot have financial interest, direct or indirect, in a retailer. Mm-hmm. This goes all the way back to the prohibition days of alcohol, where you wanted to separate the tiers. But I just thought I'd throw that in there.
So there wasn't too much of a power
base then. Exactly. Because before prohibition, the largest distillers and the largest brewers in the nation controlled all the retail outlets. So coming out of prohibition, they created a distributor in the middle to separate those tiers. We're one of the few states, if not the only state, well, I think California has a distributor tier now that they've gone legal. But that's an interesting difference between them all.
So we're 6 years out now since this process started. You know, citizens of Washington State can actually go and buy some form of cannabis legally without fear of being arrested. How's it going?
Well, I think you're talking to the regulator.
I know, but you're watching it.
So we're looking at, do we have compliance?
Yeah.
So remember, unlike Canada, we're in defiance of federal law.
Right.
It's a Schedule I controlled substance. So everything we built in that system is for Washington State. Mm-hmm. For example, one of the concerns of the federal government was diversion. How are you going to keep marijuana or cannabis from coming out of your state? So we actually hired a consultant to determine how much cannabis was consumed by persons over 21 in the state of Washington and built our system to grow only that that would serve the state. So remember, we, like Colorado, waited 9 months for the federal government to even tell us whether we're going to be able to move forward with this experiment or not. And in August of 2013, the federal government, the Department of Justice, issued what's been known as the Cole Memorandum. Mm-hmm. And it set out 8 enforcement priorities that the states that have legal cannabis must follow. There's really 3 very quick pieces to that. One is, how are you going to keep it out of the hands of youth and kids? And I can talk about that.
And that's under 21 in Washington.
Under 21, so it's the same as alcohol.
Yep.
You can possess and consume, but you have to be over 21. How are you going to keep the criminal element out, gangs, mm-hmm. cartels, from the business? And how are you going to keep it from being diverted out? Our system was really created to make sure that we lived up to those 3 principles.
So let's go through them. How did you manage to do that? Because I think that a big issue for so many people is marijuana going to be more readily available to young people? And we know that there is a psychological impact on people who have immature brains as they're growing and they consume cannabis, that it can have a psychotic response. So how do you go about ensuring that you're getting it to the intended market?
Well, 2 ways. One is, just like alcohol, we do compliance checks. They're called stings on retailers. So very much like our alcohol retailers, we have cannabis retailers, over 500 in the state, and we do compliance checks 3 or 4 a year on each of them. Mm-hmm. Our youth compliance rate right now is somewhere between 94-96%. For alcohol, it's between 76-84%. So one of the things that we did as a regulator for enforcement is really look really closely at that. Make sure we're doing a lot of compliance checks. Because we have so few retailers compared to alcohol retailers, mm-hmm. we have the ability to be able to do more compliance checks. So we're pretty proud of the fact that we have a higher youth compliance rate for cannabis than we do for alcohol. Secondly, we were concerned about edibles and infused products. Mm-hmm. What we found in the marketplace, in the gray medical marketplace, because we had a medical marketplace for years that was basically unregulated. We used to refer to it as the Wild West, mm-hmm. and we had to bring that in a couple of years ago, and we merged those together. So medical and adult use cannabis are sold out of the same retail shops. But let me get back to youth access.
Right.
Edibles and infused products. We saw what was happening in Colorado, so we put limits on how much strength or potency can be in edibles and infused products. We also have a 4-person committee on our board mm-hmm. that looks at all packaging, labeling around edibles. We knew there was gummy bears, lollipops, cotton candy, believe it or not, infused. And anything that was especially appealing to children, we don't allow. Any bright colors, they even took candies and mimicked them and placed cannabis in them. Mm-hmm. So there's 2 ways that we try to make sure we're restricting youth access to the product.
I gotta get you to hang on for a second while we take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back. Sorry for the interruption, but I need your help. I'm asking you to support the show by becoming a patron. That means pledging $1 per show. Conversations is a unique program. There's no grandstanding, no arguing, no yelling. Instead, I sit down with people who have unique insights, specialized knowledge, and experiences that inform and enlighten. And we do this on an incredibly limited budget with a very small crew. Well, this is my office and it's where I edit the show. And then once it's ready, we give it away. You know, so many different websites around the world are carrying the show, but they get it for free. They don't pay us. So I'm asking you to pledge $1 per show by going to patreon.com/conversationsthatmatter. Thanks. We want to keep producing conversations, and with your help, we can. Now let's get back to the show. So one of the other stated objectives is that you reduce the criminal element or the illegal market. How do you go about doing that? And I think about that in relationship when you're talking about restricting access to young people. So you're saying, okay, you can't have that. We all know that there are young people who will find ways to circumvent that law. They'll go get somebody else who will buy it and become a supplier, or possibly they'll go to that illegal market. What sort of measures did you put in place to start to try and control the illegal market?
Well, I just creating a legal market.
Yeah.
So when we talk about the amount of growth that's occurred, so we've had 4 years of retail sales And we've seen right now, in fact, we have our consultant looking at how much of the market is actually legal and how much is illegal. But we knew about in the third year of retail sales, like by the end of next month, for just this fiscal year, we'll probably hit $1.5 billion in sales. No one predicted that in the third or fourth year of sales, we would have that high. About $3 billion in sales over 4 years, about $1 billion in excise taxes that's mm-hmm. been collected for the state. But I think the fact that at about the third year, as soon as we got down to about $7 a gram average per mm-hmm. sale, we know that the black market and gray market, when we started, was somewhere between $8 and $10 a gram. Once we got to about $7 a gram, $8 a gram, everything changed quickly. And really, for an adult, the decision for an adult user was, why would I need to go to the black market to obtain something I can get at the same price mm-hmm. I can get at a retail shop? With the packaging and labeling that tells me what kind of potency it is, whether it's THC, whether it's CBD, whether it's a combination of both, that it's been tested. So I think in the third year we really saw things change dramatically where sales climbed because the price of the gram had come down.
So consumer behavior actually started to clamp down on the access or the interest in buying from that black market because they didn't need to. But is that $7 a gram before the tax or after the tax?
It's after the tax.
Oh, it's after the tax. Because I was going to ask you, you know, you've got a 37% excise tax on that. Does that not then drive people back to the black market?
I asked Allison Holcomb, who was the author of the initiative. I said, my goodness, why did you put such a high excise tax on this? Her answer was, it's weed, Rick. It's not that difficult to grow. So she actually looked at that. I mean, I think we're
the
highest.
She anticipated.
She did.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, many of the states, the taxes, the excise taxes are lower. But it is for alcohol, too.
Yeah.
We've got this model in our state. The excise tax for alcohol in Washington is one of the highest in the country. Mm. For cigarettes, for cannabis. We don't have an income tax in our state. The state derives its income from other sources. Mm-hmm. Over the years, it's been called sin taxes.
Yes.
And so it's consistent with the policy of the state to have a high cannabis tax.
Huh. And so then users they're used to it and they just go,
once the price is exactly the same.
Yeah.
Once there's no difference between, why would they care? Why wouldn't I want to go to a retail shop where I have a large variety mm-hmm. to choose from other than one person and what they have? And I can choose a variety of different products.
Well, and you pointed out that they're then buying a regulated product that they know has been tested. They understand the potency. But as you go from having an illegal system and you're now shifting to a legal one, all of the frameworks or the organizational structures that need to be in place to be able to measure that potency, to test growing facilities, there's different enforcement laws and a wide range of different elements of dealing with this. You're going from zero, as you pointed out, to now having this all in place. How did you go about putting that together so in a way that you knew was going to help you meet your objectives?
So I think one of the things that we did right was we took our time. So we had a whole year after legalization to create the rules and the regulations. It was passed in November. It wasn't until December 1st of the next year that the board needed to have at least its regulations in place. So we took our time. I think one of the things that we give as advice to all the states, the provinces, and the nations that we've met with is take your time. Mm-hmm. It's better to become very restrictive upfront, very conservative approach to how you're going to do this, because once the industry is here and it's licensed and it hires lobbyists, I can tell you what happens. It becomes more difficult. So we put in mm-hmm. very tight restrictions. I think the most restrictive system in the country. That's why a lot of states are looking at what we've done, because we've always said you can always loosen the regulations over time as you see necessary, but you'll have a heck of a time trying to be more restrictive with an industry once it's up and running.
Yeah.
Having regulated the alcohol industry for over 80 years, we have that experience. We know what that looks like.
Better to go tough out of the starting gate and ease off if need be, because trying to tighten up those restrictions becomes harder. What was the response from police in Washington State as you were moving towards the legalization of marijuana? Were they concerned?
Well, I think if you know police and you know law enforcement, I think probably a vast majority of law enforcement felt it was an improper public policy.
Mm-hmm.
That we shouldn't be legalizing cannabis. We know the problems that we have with tobacco and alcohol, though regulated. So I think law enforcement initially was pretty cynical about it in Washington State. We went out and met with public health, we met with the prevention community, we met with law enforcement, we've met with local governments, because many, one thing we haven't talked about, many of the, especially in eastern Washington, many of the cities and counties have imposed bans or moratorias to not allow this. So remember, 56% voted yes, 44% voted no. You've almost got half of the voting population or the citizens of the state that said no. So one of the more reasons why you begin very restrictive in the system that you put in place, because you've got almost half of the population that doesn't like the fact that you move forward. But law enforcement was very cynical about it up front. What we're doing now in 4 years of legalization is working with them to bring down the illicit grows that are occurring. And those are still there. Mm-hmm. So there's still an attempt by the black market to still hold its market. But what we're seeing, which is really interesting, is they're coming in and growing in our state and exporting it out to other states where cannabis can be sold for more money. You can pay $1,000 a pound in Washington in the legal system. On the East Coast, you can get $3,000 or $5,000 for a pound of cannabis. So unfortunately, what we're seeing is them coming in, growing, and then exporting it out to another state.
And because that's not falling under the regulated market, it's,
well, there's no market
it,
here.
Right. Yeah.
Well, we swallowed up a big piece of it, so where do they go? Well, they have to go out of the state. And that's raising concerns from feds and other states who are not legal, concerned that, well, you're bringing all this weed into our state for from your state because we became legal. The first question was, how do you know it's from the legal market? It's probably coming from the illicit illegal grows that no longer have a marketplace.
So ultimately, it's better if you have a national policy so that you don't have this black market that can go from one jurisdiction to the next. Right. So is Canada, do we have the right approach when we say we're going to do this nationally rather than province by province?
Oh, absolutely. I think some of the problems that many of the states that have gone legal now, and there's 9 for adult use, and you know, if you look at the medical, there's only 3 states in the country that don't allow some form of medical marijuana. That's amazing, because at one time there were 25, 28 states that some of the states in the South allow CBD only and in certain forms, but it is a form of allowing it in their state. But I think one of the difficulties always is the banking issue. We would typically go to the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, for example, to tell us the kind of pesticides that can be used or not used and what the action levels for those pesticides are. But because it's a federal prohibition with respect to the law to that, we have to work with the Department of Agriculture. Actually, in Oregon, helped us determine what our rules were going to be around pesticides use.
In this time that you've been in Washington State, what have you seen happen as far as cannabis use amongst adults over 21? Has it increased? Or were you just, you know, when you talk about having $3 billion in revenue, did that just catch you by surprise that you didn't really understand the size of the market? Or is the regular use of marijuana by adults increasing?
Well, I think it has increased. And you got to remember that for states like Colorado, Oregon, Washington, California, they had through the referendum process a medical marijuana law on the books for years.
Yep.
In Washington, 98, I believe Colorado, California, and Oregon around 96, 98. So this was not new. It wasn't regulated, but we've had medical marijuana in our states for many years. And even beginning then, around 2000, you could see trending up with respect to use. And so it's not just adult use legalization that created that. I want to go back to the fact that medical marijuana states, the states that have been there for quite some time, 20 years for Washington, we saw that trending up as far as adult use. What we're interested in looking at is youth use.
Yes.
And so we have what's called a healthy use survey. It's done every other year in our schools. It's 8th, 10th, and 12th graders. There's a number of questions that are asked. It's been around for about 50 years. There's a questionnaire that's asked about, did you use in the last 30 days? And we look specifically at 8th and 10th graders. I'll take the 10th grade category. We know that before legalization in 2014, before we started retail sales, it was around 17%. of those youth reporting they had used in the last 30 days. Mm-hmm. So we were really curious last year to find out what are the results. What we expected to see was a pretty, it could have been a significant climb or not, but at least yeah. it would rise with legalization. It was stagnant at 17%.
Stayed the same.
We went to public health and the prevention community and said, what in the world's going on here? Didn't we expect that it would climb? And they mm-hmm. go, well, we did, but it didn't. Now, the thing that did climb was the perception of harm had fallen. So young people were also asked, do you think it's dangerous to consume cannabis? The answer was less so, probably because of legalization for adults over 21. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that we didn't see was we didn't see a significant climb in use, which is good. Now, if you ask young people about this, and you ask them about legalization, they will tell you that cannabis was easy to get. Yes. In fact, it was easier to get than alcohol.
Or cigarettes.
Because I didn't have to try to get someone,
right.
you or me, to go purchase for them, or I didn't have to try to attempt to purchase myself. Mm-hmm. I could get it from somebody at school, because right. it was all black market. So I think for youth, to be totally honest with you, they didn't need legalization for adults to determine whether they were going to use or not, mm-hmm. or they were going to increase their use or not.
Right.
I think they made those decisions a long time ago and often contrary to what we would want as adults.
You spoke to the Canadian Senate as they're doing yep. their final preparations. What did you tell them?
I shared a lot of the experience yeah. that we had, kind of the lessons learned. I think the biggest challenge is the industry can't wait to get into this business. It's been waiting forever.
Yes.
And so it's never fast enough for them. And so I shared with the committee, take the time that you need to do this thing right, or as close to right as you can, because there's still many challenges that we have. And be conservative and be restrictive, and then open the system up as you feel your way through this. The nice thing that Canada has is experience of four states who have mm-hmm. been in it, Alaska, Colorado, Washington, and Oregon, for us 4 years of retail sales, the other two, Alaska and Oregon, 2 years. So there's a lot there that we can help with as far as packaging and labeling. And so a lot of the questions from the Senate had more to do with the practical parts of regulating the industry.
So I think you're probably a little bit like me, that you go back 20, 25 years and people were talking about legalizing marijuana. You probably thought, yeah, like as if that's going to happen. Now it has happened. Is it the right direction for us to have been going in?
Is it
the right direction for us to have been going in, moving towards legalization?
You know, I don't know that answer. I would say that the drug policy of the past failed. I think that's why people moved toward legalization,
because
incarceration.
We had a failed policy, huh?
I think it was failed. It wasn't working. I mean, it wasn't like I have young kids. It's not like they couldn't get access to cannabis. Everyone's been able to access cannabis. So I think that failed policy, but whether it's the right policy to legalize, I think it's still up for debate.
Too early to tell.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.